Hey, it's Brad Milkey, host of ABC's daily news podcast, Start Here. And I'm honored to say Start Here, along with several ABC audio projects, are up for Webby Awards. Voting is open to the public, and we're all really excited about these awards, but this vote closes on Thursday. So please don't wait. You can go to abcaudio.com/webbies. That's abcaudio.com/webbies, W-E-B-B-Y-S, to cast your vote for Start Here, along with other ABC news shows. We really appreciate it.
This Week with George Stephanopoulos starts right now.
Legal peril.
This is really prosecutorial misconduct. The two lead prosecutors, absolute human scum.
Overnight, Donald Trump escalates his rhetoric as he faces mounting legal danger and a potential indictment.
What we see before us is not equal justice.
If he keeps it up, he's going to get someone killed.
This morning, Rachel Scott and Aaron Kutursky with the latest developments. Dan Abrams and Asha Rangappa analyze Trump's legal jeopardy, plus our powerhouse roundtable. Major showdown.
The United States does not seek a conflict with Iran.
U.S. forces clash with Iranian proxies in Syria, leaving one American contractor dead. As U.S.-China tensions rise on Capitol Hill over the popular social media app, TikTok.
Your platform should be banned.
All the fallout with Congressman Mike Gallagher and Raja Krishnamoorthy. Deadly tornadoes.
Oh my gosh!
At least 26 dead, dozens more injured after powerful storms ripped through the South. The latest on the devastation with FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell. And
was your sacrifice, was this nation's sacrifice worth it?
My sacrifice was for the Constitution of the United States, and that is always worth it.
20 years after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, two veterans in Congress reflect on the war, their service, and its lasting toll.
From ABC News, it's This Week. Here now, Martha Raddatz.
Good morning and welcome to This Week. Donald Trump began his first rally of the 2024 campaign last night on a defiant note, with a hand over his heart, while a massive screen showed images of the January 6th riot, with those imprisoned for taking part in it joining in a chorus of the national anthem. Trump depicted them and himself as victims of political persecution and doubled down on his dangerous rhetoric ahead of a potential indictment by the Manhattan District Attorney. Days after warning of potential death and destruction if charged, Trump bashed prosecutors leading investigations into him, calling them, quote, human scum. There were death threats against the Manhattan DA this week and fears that protests called for by Trump could turn violent. Law enforcement has seen a spike in threats mirroring Trump's tone. We'll cover it all this morning, but we start in the South as the region braces for more severe storms after violent tornadoes ripped through Mississippi. You're looking at a live image of the trail of destruction that spanned nearly 100 miles long and left at least 26 dead, dozens more injured, and tens of thousands without power. Overnight, President Biden approved a major disaster declaration, making federal relief funds available to the hardest hit areas. Whit Johnson is there in Rolling Fork with the very latest. And Whit, the mayor said the town of about 2,000 people was completely wiped off the map.
Martha, that's right. Good morning to you. He said that most of the buildings throughout the town were destroyed, maybe a few left standing, but those are uninhabitable. And as the sun's coming up, we're just getting this panoramic view of the devastation here. Take a look behind me. We're going to go up above to our drone camera right now. I'll try to paint this picture for you. This behind me was a lumber yard. Several big structures there. Right next to it, a few neighborhoods, mostly made up of trailer homes. Sadly, that's where some of the fatalities occurred. But right now, it's all just been mixed together in this unrecognizable pile of debris. And we're seeing this as far as the eye can see, across the street, down the street. This was a 60-mile path that was cut from that one deadly EF4 tornado. And EF4s are incredibly rare. Only 1% of all tornadoes are EF4s. They're that powerful. And this is what we've heard from people who live in this community. They knew there was bad weather. They heard the warnings. They didn't have a lot of time to react, but many of them were already in their homes and started to take shelter. What they didn't expect was this. They didn't expect that when they were in their homes that the walls, the roofs, the windows all around them would be ripped to shreds. And that's why we've seen just how deadly this storm was. You noted that we spoke with the mayor here. He talked about not only the devastation, but the resilience of this community as well. We know that the search and rescue efforts are resuming this morning. They still have hope that if there's anybody buried, that they could find them alive. We also noted as we arrived here on our live shot this morning, somebody planted an American flag right in the middle of the rubble here. That just a signal of the strength and resilience. The mayor insists, despite everything you see, Martha, they will rebuild.
Whit Johnsoner, thanks to you. Stay safe down there. We're joined now by FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell. Administrator, I know you're headed to Mississippi right after this. What's the latest you're hearing from your team on the ground about search and recovery efforts?
Good morning, Martha. Thanks so much for giving me an opportunity to talk with you today. Yes, I'm headed to Mississippi right now because I want to be able to see firsthand the impacts that some of these communities have had. I know that from yesterday morning, the death toll had risen by two, and they're still very much in life-saving, life-sustaining mode. The first responders on the ground are doing such an amazing job, some of which probably have lost some of their homes themselves. And we have teams that are coming in. They arrived last night, more coming in today, to begin to help plan for and start the recovery process.
And what's the biggest priority for FEMA right now?
The biggest priority for me is, one, making sure that the local jurisdictions, those first responders, have all of the resources that they need. And then second, that we start to take care of these families. I know that the American Red Cross is on the ground standing up shelters. These are temporary shelters. We know families lost everything. And so we need to work with them now and find out what that interim sheltering solution is going to be. And then how do we support them for a longer term while they rebuild their homes?
And to that point, you've seen those devastating images from Rolling Fork. The mayor says the town is completely wiped out. So what do those residents do? Can they really rebuild?
You know, it just depends on what their level of damage is, right? And so that's one of the reasons that I'm going there today. And I know that I'm going to be able to talk with the mayor. I want to hear from him directly as what his residents need. Everybody's situation is going to be individual and unique to them. And so we want to make sure we understand what their unique needs are. And some of these communities, they are certainly some of the poorest communities in the state. And we know that we're going to have to bring the full force of the federal family in there to come help them.
And I just want to point out that we are looking at those images, and those homes are completely wiped out. Should they rebuild?
Again, everybody's situation is going to be really specific and unique to them. It's, you know, tornadoes like this, it's really hard to predict exactly where they're going to go. I think the one thing as people start to think about rebuilding is whether or not they can put a safe room in and providing that level of protection. Because right now, the most important thing is making sure that people have a safe place to be when storms like this break out again in the future.
And there were tornado warnings in place, but what about access to those warnings? Sirens are not always reliable or in place even, and cell phones are good, of course, but 35% of the residents in the county live below the federal poverty line, and they may not carry cell phones with a warning system. How are they supposed to be warned?
I think it's something that we have to continually look at what we can do to better inform people. We know that there are sirens. I know that some sirens did go off. I don't have, you know, the exact picture of where they went off. But sirens are one of the best tools that we do have to give a widespread of warning to people quickly, especially when you have nocturnal tornadoes like this that happen while people are asleep. Our emergency alert system that goes through the cell phones is another great way to get warning. But we need to really talk to these families and find out how they would have better gotten this message, because we have to always work on giving people early warning so they can take action, so they have enough time to take action to protect themselves and their families.
Okay, thanks so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it. Safe travels.
Thank you, Martha.
And to politics now. Donald Trump returned to the campaign trail last night in Waco, Texas, for his first rally of the 2024 campaign, sounding off about prosecutors in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and the looming threat of an indictment.
The weaponization of our justice system is not
as some have called it, a political spectacle. This is the central issue of our time.
Senior investigative reporter Aaron Kuchersky is standing by at the courthouse in Lower Manhattan with the latest on the investigation. But let's first turn to senior congressional correspondent Rachel Scott right there in Texas. Good morning, Rachel.
Martha, good morning. And Donald Trump is as defiant as ever, making it clear that any possible indictment will not stand in the way of him running for president in 2024. In fact, the former president really leaning into his legal troubles, making it a central focus of his campaign message last night. You heard him there telling his supporters that the central issue of our time is the, quote, weaponization of our justice system. The investigations into the former president are starting to ramp up as the 2024 presidential election cycle begins to take shape. Trump spending much more time focused on the challenges surrounding him than the issues before our country, Martha.
And Rachel, Trump also pulled no punches yesterday going after his top rival in the 2024 primary race, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
Martha, Trump actually took credit for DeSantis's political success, saying that he got him elected as governor in 2018. He then went on to say that he's not a big fan of DeSantis, insisting that he's, quote, dropping like a rock. As for the Florida governor, we know that he's out touring these key early states, really testing the waters, pitching Florida as a conservative model for the rest of the country. Sources tell us that he would likely announce that he's running for president after the legislative session ends in Florida in May. But Trump making one thing very clear: if DeSantis is in, he sees him as his biggest threat, Martha.
Thanks, Rachel. Let's turn now to Aaron Kuchersky. And Aaron, Trump's rhetoric about a potential indictment over those hush money payments has led to very real threats targeting Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg.
There have been multiple threats, Martha. And with Trump continuing to press these verbal attacks, the courthouse is increasing its physical security. Martha, Trump predicted he would be indicted by now. The next chance that could happen comes tomorrow.
New York City courts are stepping up security as the grand jury is expected to return Monday to hear evidence of how former President Trump accounted for a hush payment to porn actress Stormy Daniels. It is the most salacious element in the swirl of legal trouble around the former president and may be his most immediate threat. Trump's increasingly hostile rhetoric about the case and the prosecutor has put the courthouse behind metal barriers and compelled Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg to up his own security, while reassuring his staff they would not be intimidated. After falsely claiming he would be arrested last Tuesday, Trump made an ominous claim about the consequences of an indictment, writing on social media it could result in potential death and destruction. On Friday, a letter addressed to Bragg contained a death threat, saying, "Alvin, I'm going to kill you," in a white powder, later deemed non-hazardous. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries blasted Trump's rhetoric.
"It's dangerous, and if he keeps it up, he's going to get someone killed. We've already seen the consequences of incitement from the former president."
Trump's connection to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol is still being investigated by a special counsel. The judge rejected executive privilege claims and ordered then-Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and other top Trump aides to testify. And there are new developments in the special counsel investigation of Trump's handling of classified materials after he left the White House. Special counsel Jack Smith successfully fought to bring Trump attorney Evan Corcoran before a grand jury in Washington on Friday. Sources told ABC News the special counsel believes Trump intentionally and deliberately misled his lawyers about retention of documents with classified markings. While attorney-client privilege typically shields lawyers from testifying, a judge was convinced there was preliminary evidence that Trump may have used Corcoran to advance a criminal scheme. Compared to those investigations and their implications for national security and democracy, the New York case, centered around an alleged affair and allegedly falsifying business records, may seem less consequential. But it may be closest to resolution and involves the kind of charge routinely brought by the Manhattan District Attorney.
Once the grand jury reconvenes here, it will do so under tighter security, and it could hear from at least one additional witness. Martha?
Aaron Kuchersky, thank you. Let's break down these cases now with our experts, ABC News Chief Legal Analyst Dan Abrams and Asha Rangappa, Assistant Dean at the Yale Jackson School of Global Affairs, also a former FBI special agent. Thanks for joining us this morning, both of you. And Dan, let me start with you. As we just heard, all eyes are on the Manhattan DA this week, but the case seems to hinge on a legal theory that's never really been used in New York. How risky is this?
Look, it's risky for a number of reasons. The new theory is in getting it from the misdemeanor to the felony. They're kind of jerry-rigging it to some degree. And the reason that that's novel and it's difficult, it hasn't been quite done exactly in this way before, but there's also another factor here, which is this isn't just a misdemeanor case that they're trying to get into a felony. It's also a 7-year-old case. It's also a case that two other sets of prosecutors, the previous DA and the federal prosecutors, decided not to move forward with. So, you know, when people say to me sometimes, well, if this had been me, I would have been prosecuted for sure. My response is, if this had been you, I don't know that 7 years later they would have revisited this misdemeanor and tried to turn it into a felony. So it is a challenging legal theory. They may be able to do it, but there are problems here.
And Asha, what problems do you see?
Martha, I think that it depends on which legal theory they choose. So if the Manhattan DA's office tries to tie this to a state or federal campaign violation, I do agree with Dan that they can encounter some significant legal issues. But there is a pathway where the DA could tie this to the Trump Organization's business practices, and in particular, tax fraud. This is the same legal theory that they use to prosecute the Trump Organization. And they've had a window into the Trump Organization's business practices through that trial, which is maybe why they have resurrected this case. This has been known as the zombie case because it came back to life. But that could be what changed. And I think that they would be on stronger footing if they go down the road of tax violations that directly impact the state of New York.
And Asha, I want to stay with you. You were an FBI special agent. When you hear Donald Trump's rhetoric, he's called for protests, warned of potential death and destruction. How does law enforcement even prepare for that?
Well, at this point, we know that he has some followers who may act on his rhetoric. After the search at Mar-a-Lago last August, there was someone who showed up at the FBI office in Cincinnati with an AR-15. You know, someone else crashed into a barricade at the U.S. Capitol. So I think the problem here is going to be the potential for lone wolf violence. I don't think that there's going to be the kind of organized protest that we saw on January 6th. But I think that they do need to prepare for that. And we need to also look out for this information vacuum that may exist between the time that the DA is negotiating the surrender and when the charges are actually made public. And that's a time when Trump can really, you know, spin and say what he wants without the Manhattan DA really being able to respond or correct the record. So that is what I think that they're going to need to prepare for.
And Dan, let's turn to that documents case that Asha mentioned. How significant could the testimony of Trump's lawyer be?
See, I think that case is a much more significant one. And we also can't underestimate how important it is that a court has required his lawyer to testify. That almost never happens here. And what a court ruled and then an appellate court upheld was what's called this crime fraud exception, meaning that the legal advice that was given in furtherance of a crime. They've already determined that, meaning that's the only reason that the lawyer is being required to testify, where the attorney-client privilege is being pierced. Just that makes it already a really big deal as to where we are in that case. And so regardless of exactly what the testimony was of his lawyer, the fact that the court and now the courts have determined that there was a crime, that that legal advice was given in furtherance of it, already tells you a lot about where that investigation is.
And Asha, it also makes clear the difference between Donald Trump's case and that of Mike Pence and Joe Biden regarding classified documents.
Absolutely. I think that by piercing that attorney-client privilege, what prosecutors have is the opportunity to demonstrate that Trump actively lied and misled his own lawyers and knew that he still had these classified documents and really tried to prevent law enforcement and from getting to them. And this stands in stark contrast to the full cooperation
of both the vice president and President Biden in terms of turning over documents. And I think would be easier to distinguish why Trump's case would be prosecuted and theirs is not.
And Dan, just very quickly, if you could, Trump still faces a very real threat of being indicted in Georgia.
Yeah, that's another potentially serious case related to overturning of the election. And we expect to hear from the Fulton County DA any day now, because a special grand jury, which is just an advisory grand jury there, clearly has already advised, suggested that there be charges in connection with that case as well.
Thanks to you both for joining us. The roundtable is coming up. Plus, after TikTok CEO was grilled on Capitol Hill, is Congress ready to ban the popular social media app? Our interview with the leaders of the House committee taking on China. Next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
TikTok is the spy in Americans' pockets.
Your company continues to feed our children this dangerous and harmful content.
Quite frankly, your testimony has raised more questions for me than answers.
Your platform should be banned.
There are more than 150 million Americans who love our platform, and we know we have a responsibility to protect them.
Lawmakers on Capitol Hill hammering TikTok CEO over his company's ties to China. Joining us now are the leaders of the new House committee investigating China, Chairman Mike Gallagher and Ranking Member Raja Krishnamoorthy. Both also serve on the Intelligence Committee. We're going to get to TikTok in a moment. But Congressman Gallagher, you're also on the Armed Services Committee. So I want to start by asking you about the attacks targeting U.S. bases in Syria that left an American contractor dead, several service members wounded. The Biden administration retaliated with airstrikes targeting Iranian-backed militias believed to be responsible, but that didn't seem to stop them. What more should we be doing?
Well, I think we should be concerned that our deterrent posture vis-a-vis Iran is crumbling. We can't afford another failure of deterrence like that which we saw in Ukraine. Some practical steps going forward, in my opinion, would be to reimpose a policy of maximum economic pressure, abandon an attempt to resuscitate the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as well as force the Pentagon to deliver something they're late on, which is a report on the U.S.-Israeli Technology Working Group, which should have a suite of practical proposals for how we can turbocharge our technological cooperation with the Israelis, help them better defend against the threat of missiles, help us better defend against the threat of Iranian missiles or Iranian proxy militias. So, very concerning. More we need to do, and we need to have a clear-eyed view of the regime we're facing in Tehran.
And Congressman Krishnamoorthy, the 900 American service members and hundreds of contractors in Syria, they're supposed to be part of an anti-ISIS mission. So why is this happening if we're there to fight ISIS?
Well, I think that we're kind of targets of opportunity for these Iranian-backed militias, but we're not going anywhere. We have to stay in northern Syria. And work with our partners in Iraq as well in fighting ISIS. And I think the Biden administration did exactly what it had to do in responding to these Iranian militias. I believe there have been 78 attacks by these militias during the Trump administration and now the Biden administration. And unfortunately, we're going to have to deal with them appropriately, but we're not leaving that part of the world as we deal with ISIS.
And Congressman Gallagher, another subject. Russia's President Vladimir Putin also announced yesterday that Russia would be deploying tactical nuclear weapons to Ukraine's neighbor Belarus. How concerned are you about that?
Well, Putin has engaged in nuclear saber rattling since the start of this crisis. It's something to be concerned about, but we should not allow his threats to deter us. We can't allow that to be a cause for delaying critical weapons system that we need to deliver to the Ukrainians. I think broadening this out, we need to understand that Putin is Xi Jinping's junior partner. He is Xi's agent of chaos, his tethered goat in Europe. And if we try and separate these problem sets, I think we're going to result in a geopolitical posture that's ineffective. These are two countries who increasingly are allied against the West, trying to undermine us. And so we have to understand what we're up against and make sure that we are rearming so that we can learn lessons from Ukraine and apply them to places like East Asia, for example.
Okay, let's turn to TikTok CEO Xiao Chu's testimony on the Hill. He strongly pushed back on lawmakers' assertion that the Chinese government can access Americans' data, insisted Americans' data is stored in the U.S., an initiative they call Project Texas. Congressman Krishnamoorthy, did anything he say assuage your concerns?
No, it did not. I think that it created more concerns, quite frankly. I'll just point to a few things. One is that he was not willing to call what the Chinese employees of ByteDance did in spying on American journalists and citizens as being spying. Everybody was scratching their head when he actually said that. He also was unwilling to acknowledge that there's a genocide going on with regard to the Uyghur people in Xinjiang province in the northwest corner of China. Again, bowing to pressure from this Chinese Communist Party. And then finally, there's a saying, don't mess with Texas, but Project Texas is a mess. There are whistleblowers coming forward saying that whatever the TikTok management is saying about Project Texas is a pack of lies, and that even when they erected this firewall, supposed firewall, with regard to data of American users, these Chinese employees of ByteDance, the parent company, were able to spy on American journalists. So unfortunately, I don't think that he did TikTok any favors through his testimony.
And Congressman Gallagher, how likely is it that there will be a ban?
Well, I actually think after that hearing, and that same day on Capitol Hill, there were two other hearings related to China, including a hearing we held on the ongoing Uyghur genocide, the largest ethno-religious internment since the Holocaust. So it's horrific that the CEO was unwilling to answer questions. And to footstomp Raja's point, the only reason that would explain his evasiveness is fear of angering his overlords in the Chinese Communist Party. I think this has actually increased the likelihood that Congress will take some action. We have the only bipartisan bicameral bill that would allow for either a ban or a forced sale to an American company. And the key part that is missing from Project Texas's mitigation strategy is control of the algorithm. That's really what we need to address. It's not just exfiltrating data from an American phone. It's what they're able to push to Americans through the algorithm, control our sense of reality, control the news, meddle in future elections. They've actually united Republicans and Democrats out of a concern of allowing the CCP to control the most dominant media platform in America.
And Congressman Krishnamoorthy, there are 150 million TikTok users. Most of them are younger people. The Secretary of Commerce, Gina Raimondo, recently said that if TikTok is banned, you are literally going to lose every voter under 35. Your response?
Well, I think that good policy makes good politics. And in this particular case, we have to recognize that while TikTok is another social media app and we have a generalized concern about these social media apps, it's different in kind from any other social media app because its parent company is beholden to the Chinese Communist Party. That is why, on a bipartisan basis, we've banned TikTok from all federal devices. And that's why the FBI director, the director of national intelligence, the CIA director, and the entire intelligence community believes this is a severe risk to our national security, and we have to deal with it.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us. You've got a long road ahead. The roundtable's next. We'll be right back.
You'll see some numbers that are incredible. You'll see some numbers that are weak. This one had one today, 69 for Trump, and I think 18 or 19 for the sanctimonious.
You know, you can call me whatever you want. I mean, just as long as you also call me a winner, because that's what we've been able to do in Florida.
Donald Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis already squaring off. So let's bring in our roundtable, former DNC chair Donna Brazile, Politico columnist Alex Burns, New York Times national political reporter Ested Herndon, and Sarah Isger, former Trump Justice Department spokesperson, now an ABC contributor. Welcome on this Sunday morning. Donna, I'm going to go straight to you. I don't know whether you watched it, but you certainly heard about Donald Trump last night saying the Pledge of Allegiance and the January 6th prisoners on tape singing the national anthem. It was a really a look back at grievances and a look ahead at more.
First of all, I watched it. As you know, once my team was unable to really get ahead in the Sweet 16, I had nothing to do. So from 6 p.m. until 7:45 p.m., I watched him. Of course, I was drinking something stronger than water, but we will not discuss that. Look, Donald Trump yesterday played the victim card. He played all of his grievances, the best of Donald Trump, with a little bit of sprinkling of what he's been talking about lately, which is, I'm being prosecuted. Come to my defense. I need your help. You know, the whole thing with the fingers and the hands and the like. It's despicable what he's doing. Donald Trump is a leading front runner in the Republican primary. Leading front runner. There's no one even close to him, although Governor DeSantis has tried to catch up. But he is the front runner, and for the front runner of a major political party to incite his crowds the way he is doing, it should be condemned by everyone. There's no place in America for the kind of political violence that he's projecting with these upcoming court cases.
Sarah, were you surprised by any of it?
No, I mean, it certainly is different than what we saw at this point in 2015. Donald Trump in 2015 was running as the change candidate. He wasn't tied to any record. He was able to say whatever he wanted about the problems that people had and how he was going to solve them. That's very different than the 2023 Trump that we're seeing. You're also seeing Ron DeSantis, I think, pursue a different strategy than what we saw from 2016 candidates. You know, in 2016, every candidate was trying to just be that person who would be up against Trump. You don't have that this time because the dynamic with Trump and DeSantis really has turned into a bit of a binary race. It looks in a lot of ways much more like the Hillary Clinton-Barack Obama primary from 2008 in some ways, where you have the change candidate now is Ron DeSantis, not allowing Donald Trump to flank him on any issues, but trying to draw that contrast as we saw that he's the winner and Donald Trump has lost so many of these recent races.
And Alex, polling does show Trump ahead. DeSantis hasn't announced yet, of course.
No, he hasn't. And I think to Sarah's point about the 2008 comparison, at this point in 2007, Barack Obama had been in the race for more than a month, right? That when you start out behind against a universally known candidate, you kind of got to get in the ring, right? And I do think there, what you hear more and more from Republicans, certainly in Washington, is this anxiety that there was this window right after the midterm elections where it was a totally mainstream, widely discussed view in the Republican Party that Donald Trump really blew it in 2022, and maybe it was time maybe it was time for somebody else. And that window, it's not that it's closed, but that it might be a little bit narrower than it was 3 or 4 months ago. And that when DeSantis gets in, assuming he does get in, it might be a slightly harder fight than it would have been 8 or 12 weeks ago.
And instead, we had DeSantis, let's go back to his Florida here.
Yeah.
He announced an expansion of the controversial law, Don't Say Gay, to all grades
yeah.
now. Is that going to help him?
This is a fight he is intentionally picking. We have seen him use the governor's office for these kind of set plays to be able to pick and choose a slice of a Republican culture war that he wants to see the friendly media, that he wants to get on Fox News, and that's how he's raised his profile away from those other challengers. But it has also got him into trouble. His position on Ukraine is one that he has had to walk back over the last couple weeks and has created some daylight for other candidates, folks like Nikki Haley, folks like Mike Pence, who are also looking at 2024 to try to take a slice from him. Ron DeSantis is doing a very careful dance even before he gets into the race, trying to speak to the MAGA base of Donald Trump while also looking at the broader Republican electorate. But Donald Trump is a values-driven candidate. Now, it is a grievance value, but he's not going to calibrate based on what he thinks he has to triangulate around the base with. And the other candidates, I think, are also pulling from DeSantis in a different way, that we've seen him be on the defensive in the last couple weeks. And I think that speaks to Alex's point about the growing window of nervousness, that he may have missed that window.
And Sarah, you worked on Republican campaigns. Are these cultural issues a good thing for Republicans to be hitting? It didn't really help them in the midterms.
Well, look at, for instance, the Glenn Youngkin race in Virginia coming off of 2020. And you can argue that, in fact, the school issues mm-hmm. and the crime issue were incredibly effective. In 2022, you didn't see it work for those candidates that made it much more about revisiting the 2020 election, much more about Donald Trump. So I'm not sure we quite know how the issues actually will fare with candidates who are pursuing them like a Glenn Youngkin. But I think that Ron DeSantis is threading that needle incredibly well on those issues in particular for a Republican primary. And at this point, like Donna said, Donald Trump is the prohibitive front runner in the polling. But the national polling doesn't matter. What's going to matter is if Donald Trump loses big in Iowa and goes to New Hampshire and can't hold on, this whole thing is totally different.
Mm-hmm. And Donna, let's not leave out Joe Biden here. What he's doing and angered some Democrats is moving to the center.
I don't think so. I know people believe that, you know, the decision on D.C. I thought was really terrible decision because I support home rule and there was no need to interfere in local affairs. But on immigration and some of the other
new
issues.
New oil drilling.
Oh, the oil drilling and trying to make sure that the United States remain competitive, that we can produce our own petroleum. And then he's also, you know, blocked off a lot of federal land for conservation efforts. Look, Joe Biden this Tuesday will start an Invest in America tour where he's going to spend the next 2 to 3 weeks along with members of his cabinet, the vice president, when she returns from Africa. They're going to begin to talk directly to the American people on the anxieties and concerns that everyday Americans have. I want to say some on these culture wars. You know, this is the Republican going through another round of silly season. It doesn't matter what happened in Virginia. I mean, but to begin to, you know, basically outlaw drag queens. They had somebody go into a quote-unquote drag show to see if they were drag queens. I mean, if you want to learn how to dance, come to my house. Don't wait for a queen. Just come on, okay? I'll invite you over. But Ron DeSantis is running on a 1950s America, not a 2050 America, America of the future. So I think Joe Biden will have a real good advantage going into the 2024.
And Alex, talk about Joe Biden. What do you see?
Oh, I think there's no question that he's doing his best to sort of claim that center ground. And, you know, people close to the president will say, look, he's always been more of a centrist. And that's true. But I think for his first 2 years, when he had unified Democratic control of Congress, he did an awfully careful job of, you know, cranking up that fog machine to sort of blur the ideological differences within his own party. And now I think he's facing a divided Congress. He's facing an emboldened, in some ways, a Republican Party, certainly on the Hill. He's looking at a fight for reelection that, you know, certainly not going to be easy, assuming that he does run. And yeah, he's trying to minimize his political vulnerabilities on energy, on immigration, on crime. I think the risk to Republicans here, Martha, you know, Donna and Sarah are talking about the Virginia election in 2021. What worked so well for Glenn Youngkin was not just talking about culture war issues. It was tapping into the white hot anger of parents and families in that moment about the way education worked at the height of the pandemic and their fears about crime. And I think that when you're talking about drag queens and when you're sort of fine tuning sort of specific school by school curriculum choices based on sort of pretty right wing cultural instincts, I'm not sure that speaks to parents and families in the political middle. I think I'm quite sure it does not, in the same way that the Youngkin campaign did in 2021. And so the risk to the GOP is you're spending time on these niche kind of sort of internet right-wing issues while Joe Biden is out there minimizing his political vulnerability.
Go ahead.
But there's a difference in audience, I think, too, for what the Glenn Youngkins were thinking about that general election audience, Virginia. You know, Ron DeSantis, Donald Trump are thinking about the Republican primary. And so, unfortunately, you know, for that audience, we have seen those kind of internet culture war, pick and choose your grievance issues really rise to the top. I mean, CPAC, which certainly was a diminished event this year, still functions as a kind of intellectual, ideological core of that America First movement. And you see that reflected in all the candidates' language, not just Donald Trump, not just Ron DeSantis, but when Nikki Haley, Mike Pompeo, even Tim Scott, someone who's supposed to be an inspirational type figure in the Republican Party, reflects the type of grievance-driven fear that's really motivating a lot of the Republican base. And so while there is certainly a gap between where that rhetoric is in a general election audience that we saw in the midterms, these folks are thinking about a Republican primary where it still seems like that's the plurality of where the electorate
is. And you do talk to a lot of people across the country about this. Let's turn to Donald Trump's legal problems. Mm-hmm. Do you think he has said in the past that he thought that would help him if he was indicted? Do you think it will? And particularly with independents, how will they see that outside of the hardcore?
I think that when you talk about independence, when you talk about outside the hardcore, the picture is much worse for Donald Trump. It is undeniable that there is a legitimate backlash to folks thinking not only there is just generally too much drama, which is the lane Ron DeSantis has tried to take, but there's a legitimate feeling of a criminal element that deserves to be indicted. Even the small amount of polling we see on this say most Americans both, even when we talk about Alvin Bragg's decision, have thought that this could be political, and it was believable because it's something that you can see Donald Trump doing. The thing is, again, back to the point about the audience, is that Donald Trump is using the language of victimhood more broadly just about himself. This is a Republican Party that has become victims on every level of the federal government, the DOJ, the FBI, and they are saying that this prosecution is another instance of that. So for the hardcores, it'll stay. For the independents, I don't think so much.
And Sarah, you worked in the Justice Department. You're watching all of this. The House Judiciary Committee has demanded Alvin Bragg testify and share records. He says, no way. Now they're saying they might look at legislation.
This is the problem when both sides believe that the other side already broke the rules. And so you have the left saying that Donald Trump has already broken all the norms, has already undermined the rule of law. So it's okay if we bring sort of charges that don't really work, that are, you know, bootstrapped, as Dan was saying earlier in the show, because he's guilty of stuff, right? You know, cut down all the laws in England to get to the devil. And Republicans are saying, look, they've undermined the rule of law, and so we now have carte blanche to do what we need to do to prevent them. It's a dangerous thing, and we've seen it over and over again on all sorts of issues in this country.
A lot to watch going forward every week, a lot to watch. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up 20 years after the U.S. invaded Iraq, two veterans in Congress reflect on the war's lasting legacy. Stay with us.
Good evening, everyone. The United States had a busy day today attacking Iraq, and the war hasn't formally begun. But in the south and in the north and in the western desert, the U.S. was bombing Iraqi assets the U.S. command wants out of the way before the big push begins. Throughout Iraq tonight, most certainly in Baghdad, the next phase for millions of people is going to be very violent.
It's been 20 years since U.S. forces invaded Iraq, a war zone I traveled to dozens of times during those years. And I've seen the toll the war took on U.S. service members. For many, their time overseas led them to continue a life of public service back home. Some 35 Iraq War veterans serve in Congress, and I sat down with two of them, Senator Tammy Duckworth and Congressman Dan Crenshaw, to reflect on the war two decades later. Senator Tammy Duckworth is reminded of the sacrifices she has made every day. She was one of the first women to fly combat missions in the Iraq War and one of the first grievously injured. When a rocket-propelled grenade pierced her Black Hawk helicopter in 2004, she lost both her legs and badly injured her right arm.
I thought I deserved to lose my legs. I hurt my crew. I didn't do my job. I failed as a pilot, and I had not served honorably. I had not served according to my training. My husband caught me crying in my hospital bed, and when he realized I was awake, and he said, "What's wrong?" And I said to him, I could barely talk, and I said, "I crashed an aircraft. It's my fault." He said, "No, you didn't." And he said, "No, you landed the aircraft." And I sort of thought, really? I've been fine ever since.
That was more important than anything, knowing you didn't cause it.
Knowing that I did my job when the chips were down, as I was trained, as an officer, I didn't let them down, and as a pilot, I didn't let my crew down.
When President George W. Bush announced the invasion of Iraq,
"These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign."
Duckworth didn't support the reasons behind the war, but never hesitated going into combat.
I was proud to go because it was my job as a soldier to obey all lawful orders, and this was a lawful order.
And was your sacrifice, was this nation's sacrifice, worth it?
My sacrifice was for the Constitution of the United States, and that is always worth it.
Congressman Dan Crenshaw, a former Navy SEAL, lost an eye in combat in Afghanistan in 2012, but had previously deployed to Iraq. When you look back on the decision to go into Iraq that George Bush made, what do you think?
It's a complicated situation. It's super easy to look back in time and say, well, I could have done this better. 2020 hindsight's a wonderful thing. Mistakes were made. Was the entire thing a mistake? I don't think you'll ever know because you can't talk about what the counterfactual is.
Crenshaw was in Iraq from 2008 to 2010, watching as the U.S. began to draw down troops.
By 2010, I'm leading a platoon in Ramadi. But it's much the same as it was in 2008. We did run into some, say kinetic warfare at times, but it was nothing like 2006, and certainly nothing like what I faced in Afghanistan in 2012.
But 3 years later, ISIS swept in, filling the gap left behind by the U.S.
2014, we're back because of ISIS. You think that was pretty easy to see?
I think it was painfully obvious. Again, all of these bad guys we were tracking, they were always in Syria, always in the eastern side of Syria, right on the border. That was their safe haven, right? It was the equivalent of Pakistan for the Taliban in Afghanistan. So pretty obvious that they were laying in wait. Pretty obvious that it's American presence that was keeping them there. You know, we were in a pretty stable place by the end of 2011. We weren't investing a massive amount of resources, and that should have been a lesson.
Both Crenshaw and Duckworth say there are many lessons to learn about war from their own experiences.
We better know what the parameters of the fight are going to be and what the end goal of the fight will be, so that we're not stuck there for decades with no off-ramp.
War sucks, which is why you should try and prevent it. You don't prevent it by being weak and letting people bully you around. You don't prevent it by waiting until the last minute to act.
And despite the outcome of these wars, their own injuries, and those that thousands of veterans still endure, they both remain immensely proud of their service.
I look back at my military experience and think it's the best experience of my life. It's a time in my life that I don't regret for a second, even with the missing eye. We're an all-volunteer force, and we go to do the bidding of the United States. And I don't want anyone to feel sorry for us. I don't want anyone to still feel sorry for me because of my injuries. I chose to do what I did.
Like a lot of soldiers, there's a part of me that, you know, if you ask me to do it again, I'd do it all over again because I gained so much more than I ever gave up.
Our thanks to all of our veterans and their families. That's all for us today. Thanks for sharing part of your Sunday with us. Check out World News Tonight and have a great day.